It's a real pleasure to introduce Stuart Neuberger, who is both our speaker and the author of this book, The Forgotten Flight, a copy of which I have here, and is now available in the bookshops. So Stuart will tell you all about that. My job is merely to introduce him and then hand over. So he is, as you could imagine, a very experienced lawyer working in a range of areas, but particularly in these complex international disputes, which often involve actions against governments, as the story here shows, and Libya features pretty prominently there. He's had many years of trial and appellate advocacy, and specializes in these public policy types of issues all around the world. This book is, if you haven't looked at it, it really is a gripping story. It's very nicely written. I am amazed at the detail that Stuart has been able to provide, the detail of particularly the French investigation, which is both fascinating and extremely detailed. But it is a very useful way to see how these long-term investigations unfold and how complicated it can be, and indeed how luck plays a part. We mustn't forget Lady Fortune. She is quite important in these sorts of investigations. Things just fall into place. All right, so I'll introduce Stuart. I'll now introduce our three commentators before I hand over to Stuart. First of all, we have Professor Dan Sarucci. Hello, Dan. Professor of International Law and Fellow of Queen's College. We have Dr. Rebecca Mooney, who's a member of Wilson, Associate Research Fellow of the Oxford Law Faculty, an experienced lawyer herself before turning to the academic world, where she undertook a doctorate, which has now been published, a very, very well-received book. Last but not least, we have Mr. Kaveh Mousavi, a member of Wilson, who in many ways is responsible for our contact with Stu. Kaveh is an indefatigable advocate for human rights, with some reference to Iran particularly, but more generally also. He's especially interested in the tracing of ill-gotten gains by corrupt rogues, and he's proving very adept at that. And he also was quite heavily involved in the defense of prisoners or inmates at the Guantanamo Bay. So we have an extremely diverse, and yet there are certain common grounds amongst our panelists tonight. So we look forward to a very lively discussion. So the format will be, Stu will talk for 25, 30 minutes, max. Then we'll have briefish comments from our panelists, and then there'll be plenty of time, we hope, for your comments and questions and discussion. So, Stu, over to you.
Dennis. Thank you. We seem to have locked the doors. You'll never get out. It's a very effective way to keep an audience's attention, I think. I should use that more often. Well, thank you, Dennis, for that very kind introduction. And thank you all for coming. And I understand they're recording this, so it'll be a podcast. So in our modern age, lots more people will hear this when they click onto the internet on some website with the college or whoever gets it onto the web. Let me just start by saying that it's a great honor to come here to Oxford and to Wolfson, of course. I've been practicing law based out of Washington, D.C. for a fairly long time. I'm older than I may look. And I began my career in Washington after getting out of law school. I clerked for a federal judge, and then I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, which represents the interest of the United States in both criminal and civil cases. And one of the things I did when I was in the government was representing the State Department, the CIA, the NSA, and other matters that touched on national security. So when I left the government and I joined my firm, where I've been now for 28 years, I had a little bit of experience dealing with not just the U.S. government, but how the U.S. government would get entangled in international disputes. And that kind of opened the door a crack for me to get into this field. Different people approach this in different ways. But at my firm, I very slowly but steadily developed an interest in a practice that really dealt with a hybrid of international disputes, some of which are under U.S. law, some of which are under international law, treaties particularly, some of which are in international venues, whether at The Hague, here in London, Paris, Vienna, Stockholm. I've tried cases around the world. And so I come at this subject with a fairly broad background of international work in many different fields. One of the things that is a bit unique to the U.S., and now Canada more recently, but not here in the U.K., is that for the last 20 years, and I tell the story in the book, for the last 20 years, in a special law enacted by Congress and signed by President Clinton in 1996, we have something called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which is a very, very narrow, very careful way that Congress allows the federal courthouse doors to be open to sue foreign countries. And for 20 years before that, it was really just for commercial cases, enforcing arbitration agreements, which, by the way, you do have here in the UK and many other countries. But in 1996, Congress enacted what's called the terrorism exception to the FSIA, and that created something very different. It said Americans who were killed or injured in terrorist attacks outside the U.S. can sue that country responsible for it, state sponsorship of terrorism, but only, and this is the key, only if that country is on a list of terrorist states maintained and published by the Secretary of State and the Department of State. So basically, it's a limited exception to a limited exception with a limited exception. That's perhaps the best way to describe it in lay terms. And in 96, I started getting some cases, mostly against Iran, which is, of course, the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, hostages held in Lebanon, and that sort of thing.
Embassy
bombings, that sort of thing. I'm the embassy bombing guy. It's quite a niche to have. And so in 2001, 2002, I was approached by a company out of Atlanta that is in the aircraft leasing business, the third largest in the world. They had 100 commercial jets, most of them jumbo jets, that they lease to airlines around the world, including BA, Air France, Lufthansa, U.S. Airlines. And in September 1989, one of their DC-10 jumbo jets, manufactured by McDonnell Douglas, now part of Boeing, disappeared while flying on its route between Brazzaville, Congo, and N'Djamena, Chad, and Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, which I'm sure many of you have gone through. It was a plane that went back and forth to these former French colonies, I think on a daily basis, and carried a number of French citizens, businessmen, diplomats, correspondents, oil workers, and a lot of Africans who maintained homes or had family in France. And this was September of 1989, a little over 9 months after Pan Am 103, another jumbo jet, blew up while flying from Heathrow to JFK, New York, and crashed into a small town in Scotland called Lockerbie. Now, obviously, Lockerbie is been one of the seminal events, not just in the UK, but in the world and in the US, in terms of terrorism. We, for those of you who are too young, there's a few of you here to remember it, it really defined the terrorism, particularly before September 11 and the attacks. And just the word Lockerbie, particularly here in the UK, everyone knew what that meant. Terrorism by a rogue state, blowing up airplanes, killing hundreds of people, terrifying people who fly. It was designed to terrorize. But when 9 months later, a French plane, UTA was a French airline, since absorbed by Air France, by the way. So it was a French operation flying an American plane. When it disappeared off the radar, nobody really associated that with the Pan Am Lockerbie. Could have been a crash. You know, Africa, who knows, the air traffic control systems, the maintenance workers. But the French, on their own, this was a totally French operation, realized that with the 170 people killed when this debris was found in the remote Tanier Desert, that that probably was sabotage. It wasn't negligence. And when they found remnants in the baggage hold of pieces of Samsonite luggage and had little bits of traces of pentrite, which is plastique explosive, they knew this was clearly a terrorist attack, but they didn't know who did it. They had no idea. And they had no involvement with the Scotland Yard FBI investigators who were working on the Pan Am Lockerbie matter, which, of course, was dominating the news, London, Washington, and constantly was what you heard about. Of course, it was in a village. The families went there. The TV cameras went there. You couldn't get to the site in the Tenere Desert. You had to go in by parachute. That's how the French got there. By the way, the debris of this jet still is there today. The French merely took the remains of those who were killed. But the one thing they did when the French investigator, Judge Bruguière, took it over and was told by the president of France, Mitterrand, you have to find out who was responsible for this, the biggest murder case in French history. Bruguière, who, as you'll find from the book, I spent a lot of time in his office in the Palais de Justice in Paris, he decided to have the French investigators collect from the desert 40 square miles of desert. No villages, no roads, no trees, no grass. Nothing was there except this debris of a DC-10 that blew up 7 miles above the earth. And after several years of literally French foreign legionnaires walking shoulder to shoulder next to each other, looking down to collect in little nets pieces of debris to try and reassemble the baggage area of this jumbo jet in Paris. They reassembled it somehow, just the baggage area, and the French engineers, the aerospace engineers, pretty much put it back together. This was a Humpty Dumpty kind of operation, as you can imagine. And they found a little piece of burnt circuit board with some initials on it. And they couldn't figure out where it fit in the wiring of the plane. They had all of the manuals from McDonnell Douglas in California, how the plane was put together. They couldn't figure it out. So they traveled to California, and they went to the McDonnell Douglas plant where this plane was built. And they said, could you just please tell us where this little circuit goes? Because we can't figure it out. And the McDonnell Douglas people said, it's not from our airplane. And the French said, I don't think you understand. There isn't a village within 400 kilometers of this crash site. There isn't a bird. There isn't a tree. There aren't discarded soda cans and beer cans like you'd find on the side of the road. There is literally nothing but sand. So the French then had to figure out, where did this circuit board come from? And all they had to work on was a little bit of it. I'm talking about something the size of my thumbnail. And there's a picture of it in the book, by the way. And it said DY in very, very vague letters. And after several years of dogged investigative work, this is one of the greatest detective stories in history, they tracked down to a small little shop in Taiwan, probably no bigger than this table, where the circuit board itself had been created. And they said, yes, that's our initial. We made that. And they said, well, what did you do? Well, in that time frame, this is 1988, 1989, we made about 100 of these. It's a small little operation. And we sold it to a guy down the street. And he puts them into bigger boards. So they went there. And then they talked to that person. They said, did you get the circuit boards? Yes. And what'd you do with them? Well, we sold them to a German company who assembles timers. Ooh, timers. So they go to Germany. This, of course, over several years, I'm giving you a fast forward. And they go to a company in Germany that assembled these timers, and they said, did you get these products from a company in Taiwan? Yes. In this time frame? Yes. Well, what'd you do with them? Well, we had about 100 of them. Well, who'd you sell them to? Well, there's a company in southern Germany who we sell them to, and then they sell them to customers around the world. Grasslin. They go there. They talk to the owner. They say, we're trying to find out where these went. Well, this is, by the way, we're talking now in the mid-1990s. Pre-computer, pre-internet, pre-Google. Okay? Just human intelligence, detective work, shoe leather, as we like to say in the States. And they say, do you have records? Well, not really, but they were German. They kept good records. We know the stereotype. And the guy went in the back, and he said, oh, I do have some records of those 100 timers. We did sell them to somebody. Well, who'd you sell them to? Oh, I have it right here. It's a fellow in Tripoli. Uh-huh. Here's his name. Here's the canceled check he sent us. This is before PayPal. A paper check. A receipt signed by the head of the intelligence services in Tripoli. They had him.
Slam dunk.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Now, I'm giving you a very, very fast version of a very interesting story that's in the first part of the book. But it was because of a combination of luck and dogged determination by the French investigators in what I consider, and I was a federal prosecutor in Washington for 7 years, I know a little bit about this, one of the greatest detective stories in the history of mankind. Sherlock Holmes would get on his knees and worship to something like this. Okay? It is really extraordinary. And nobody knows about it until I was hired to represent the owner of the plane years later, and there were 7 Americans on the flight who were killed. Everyone on the flight was killed. One of whom, this tells you the small world I live in, was the wife of the U.S. ambassador to Chad, Bonnie Pugh. And when I was approached with this case and I heard about this, I said, wait a minute, you mean Robert Pugh? He was the ambassador to Chad? Yes, it was his wife who was killed on the plane. She was flying back for her daughter's wedding in Charlottesville, Virginia. Well, 6 years before this terrorist attack, Robert Pugh was the deputy chief of mission, the deputy ambassador, in Beirut, Lebanon, when Hezbollah and Iran blew up the U.S. embassy in April 1983. And I was already handling that case for all the Americans who were killed and injured. It was a case against Iran. And I had already interviewed him as a witness in that case. And I had no idea that 6 years later, his wife had been killed in this tragedy. So he became our lead plaintiff in the case, Pugh versus Libya. And we used the French investigators' evidence, which I obtained. By the way, in France, the criminal files are not public, but I got them anyway. You're going to have to read the book to find out how. It's very interesting. The main reason was, after discovering that the Libyans did it with solid proof, a signed receipt from the head of intelligence, and indicting a man named Senussi, who was Gaddafi's brother-in-law and the head of all security services in Libya, President Chirac came into office and said, well, we're not going to deal with these little problems. I'm going to cut a deal with Gaddafi. These people are never going to be extradited or indicted. And we're just going to basically allow the French oil companies to go into Libya in exchange. And the French investigators and victims were so outraged that when I came along a couple of years later and told them I was putting a case against Libya together in Washington under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, they were very helpful. And that's how I got all of this forensic information and evidence. And it served as the platform for me to pursue Libya in the case in Washington, which they defended. I'm not going to give you a long explanation of it because our time is short. But let me just tell you that so much of what we did in court against the Libyan government to prove they were responsible for the UTA bombing, which the federal court made a finding of that, I convinced the administration of George W. Bush to assist us in it, and the former head of counterterrorism for the State Department, Ambassador Ted McNamara, who had been involved in the UN Security Council when they were putting the sanctions on Gaddafi. People forget, it wasn't just for the Lockerbie flight that the sanctions were imposed. It was also for the UTA flight, UTA 772. People forget this. Just another thing. But eventually, when the Lockerbie families and their lawyers cut the big deal with Gaddafi for $2.5 billion, which covered both the British and American victims, at that point, nothing was there for the French or the Africans. And at that time, we're talking now 2005, a reporter for the BBC pulled out the file about the UTA case. He said, wait a minute, there were 2 cases that were the subject of the UN sanctions, not just Lockerbie. Whatever happened to that one? And he referred to it as the Forgotten Flight. And that's where I got the name for the book. It's from the BBC. I give him full credit in there. But it's so appropriate. Because to this day, it's the forgotten flight. People don't know about the French investigation, which was a miracle. They don't know about the diplomatic embarrassment where Chirac basically threw his own people under the bus just so his oil companies could go to business in Libya as sanctions were being lifted. They don't know about what I did in Washington to get a federal court to establish that Libya did carry out this bombing. That never happened with the Lockerbie case, by the way. They got the money, but Libya never was held responsible in the U.S. courts for the Lockerbie bombing, ever. Of course, there was a criminal case that Gaddafi was forced to turn over to Libyans to be tried at a special Scottish court in The Hague. You may know a little bit about that. One of them was acquitted. The other was convicted, but several years later was allowed to be released early because of humanitarian reasons, because he was dying of cancer. Well, it turns out he lived another 3.5 years, by the way. And all the files on that are under seal, and no one's allowed to see them. That's a whole other matter. So I tell the story of UTA, and I compare it to the story of Lockerbie. The terror, the tragedy of these two aircraft bombings, how the families reacted differently, how the media was obsessed, properly so, with the Lockerbie Pan Am flight, and it became the main diplomatic tool and legal tool and political tool to try and basically strangle Gaddafi back into civilization. But I also compare it to the story of what the French did and how ultimately I used the French case, and the owner of the plane was American and the 7 American victims on the plane, to hold Libya accountable as a country. Now, there's a lot about there that's about politics and diplomacy and how this law in 1996 got enacted, had very little to do with international terrorism, had everything to do with domestic terrorism and the Oklahoma City bombing, which some of you may remember. There were some strange bedfellows in Washington that got that law enacted for reasons that had very little to do with what we're talking about today. I tell that story as well. The book is written from my own experience as the lead advocate, and so it's a little biased, of course. I don't pretend that this is, no offense, an academic exercise. This is an advocate who represented people against a brutal dictator, who murdered people, who put suitcase bombs on commercial. Have you all been on commercial airplanes? I hope. Okay, that's who was targeted here. People like you who go on airplanes and fly to Paris Charles de Gaulle or Heathrow or JFK or Washington Dulles or other international airports. That was the target of that type of terrorism. Okay? And that's why it was so important to hold Libya responsible. And you'll learn from the book about all the nuances in not just the legal sphere, but also in the diplomatic sphere, the political sphere, and ultimately the human sphere. One thing that's very important to me, because I do handle a lot of these cases, is to not forget, as we're talking about legal doctrines and diplomacy and policy, that there are human beings whose lives are directly affected by these terrible acts of terror. And sadly, we were reminded of that just 48 hours ago. There are human beings who suffer. And when I watch the news, here I am in London giving talks about this book, and I see parents crying over their children. Okay? I never get hardened to this, even though I've been in this field for 20 years and I'm pretty deep in it. That doesn't change. And we always have to remember the human element while we talk about all the other bigger issues that are important and why we're here at a world-class university to talk about it. But I try to never forget that. And you'll see that part of the story as well when you read the book, because I dedicate the book to my clients and all the people that were killed on that flight, because now they'll never be forgotten. And that was why I wrote the book. And so I thank you to let me have these introductory remarks. I wanted to keep within my time so the commentators can offer their views. Of course, I know all the 3 commentators, so this is a bit rigged, full disclosure. And they all are terrific to offer their views of what I've done here and beyond what's the book and the subject that we're discussing today. And hopefully we'll have some time for a little questioning as after we hear their comments. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, Professor Dan Sarusi will go out first.
Oh, next.
Sure. Kaveh, do you want to go?
Do you want me to go next?
Why don't you go?
Okay, Libya. Fine. Iran, I think, is the big player here. Stu has referred to Iran in passing, Hezbollah. The morality of this regime, let's think about it. 12th of February 1979 is the Iranian Revolution. The first firing squads start on the roof of a girls' school on the 14th of February. The four senior generals of the Shah were executed after a five-minute trial. And when the judge was asked, did they have lawyers? He said, oh, lawyers, you need lawyers when you want to buy a house or something. Mm-hmm. You don't need lawyers for this kind of thing. Case is straight. And from then, it was quite clear this is a regime that has no respect for the dignity of human life. And they justify the dastardly deeds that they've engaged in since then. Stu has alluded to the Hezbollah bombing of the embassy in 1983. But these things began earlier. In 1979, the first time ever in the history of diplomacy, ever, and I insist ever, an embassy was seized by a government for 444 days. And when Iran was chastised, you don't do this sort of thing. You're a party to the Vienna Convention. You're part of the basic principles of international law. Right from the days of heraldry in ancient Rome, and you do not attack diplomats because the basis of international relations is dialogue. If you abandon the means of dialogue, you're going to have to fight wars. And, you know, it's better to have dialogue. Iran pursued this for 444 days, and they were hostages, and they had no compunction about saying the ends are justifying the means. I think it is one lesson the 20th century taught us was that the means are part of the ends. If the means are not consistent with the ends, they're going to pretty much corrupt those ends. And the tale continues. The murders and assassinations, the last count is 386 identified victims of Iranian assassinations abroad. The very last one, 3 weeks ago in Istanbul, the president of GEM television, I actually had an appointment with him that evening, and he was murdered by Iranian hit teams. Now, the morality of this regime, Stu has referred to a Liberian in the American University in Beirut, one Mr. Kilburn. He was sold by Hezbollah, sold. Sold to the Libyans, because the Libyans were very frustrated. They didn't know what to do. Miss President Reagan had insisted on some sort of reaction to the bombing of the discotheque in Germany. So what do? They bought a hostage. You know, these days we talk about buying of women by ISIS and selling them and all that. But ISIS is not an isolated case. The beginnings of it go back to the Iranian Revolution of 1979. These are men who live in 7th century in Arabia, and their morality is that. And it leads to this kind of thing. They bought Kilburn, they tortured him, they hung him upside down, and they shot him in the head. Literally bought. And it was their chattel. And it goes on. The attack on the embassy was one. The attack on the aircraft. I was personally involved, and I had been involved in better part of 20 years with a major assassination where a truck bomb in July 1994 hit Amir Center, Argentinian Israeli Friendship Center in Buenos Aires, in which more people than they were killed on this flight were killed that time. Now, a very determined judge, a little bit like Stu, Alberto Nisman, a very good friend of mine, pursued this case for better part of 20 years.
Against Iran.
And that was, he proved, beyond the shadow of a doubt. I wrote 4 affidavits for him about the methods of Iranian terrorism. And he accepted them and put him into the record. The night before he was about to indict the president of Argentina, he was murdered. He was murdered. His body was discovered in his bathroom. There's an outroar, outrage, and the investigation is continuing. So Iran's reach continues. Please, do not fall for the view that we've just had Rouhani elected and this is a liberal side of the regime. Mm-hmm. It's rather like having Goering as opposed to Himmler, you know. Which do you take? I think I'd rather not take any of them. I won't say much more than that, but beyond the fact that when the Iranian Revolution came, we gave up with the law because we filed complaint after complaint after complaint. In 2017, I think that at least one faction of the Iranian regime is beginning to take the law seriously. Not least because when it attacks their money, Stu was involved very closely in seizing the better part of several $1 billion of Iran's money, and that's where it hurts. The law is beginning to come and beginning to get these people. British law, well, Dan might talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but the law is something that eventually gets you. That's why I've dedicated my life to the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well said.
Thank you, Stu and Carmen, and Dennis. It's a pleasure to be here with you this evening. And it's a real pleasure to talk about Stu's book, because it's very rare for an international lawyer who I practice as well in this area to actually see in the pages what you do on a day-to-day basis. Mm. And it's, you know, for me, it was personally gripping. I mean, you know, Philippe used the word gripping. I completely agree, because it's really gripping to actually see what, you know, all of the hours and all of the unsung work that goes into to developing these cases and prosecuting them, interacting with others to bring them to fruition. This is part of what this book does, but this book is so much more, because what it does is it weaves the story very nicely into the fabric of our political and modern political history over the last 60 years, a history which unfortunately is full of violence with terrorism. It's full of political characters. So you have Jacques Chirac, who wanted to do things his way, as opposed to, you know, doing things in a concerted effort with the Americans and the British, which had negative repercussions. In fact, there's a great line in the book where Stu says, he explains that actually the French, in the end, because as he mentioned, it was over $2 billion settlement for the Lockerbie case, and they were going to get a similar type of... They were talking about similar types of sums, but a bit less for the UTA flight. And that was with the British and the Americans, because the French had consistently said, because of Chirac's view, that he wants to push the oil companies and that will be how we'll earn the money back. It ended up that a French life would be worth one-tenth, is it? One-tenth a British or an American life. And it was only because of that that finally Chirac caved in. And that just shows that actually this is, in the end, a story about persistence. Because instead of being faced with the intransigence of Chirac and trying to get through Chirac's intransigence, Stu took the route around the intransigence, which was to go and work with the Americans, which of course were close to the home, but you know, it still was a more difficult route in some ways, because you had to get Congress to pass laws to allow you to do this. That's not an easy thing. Believe me, I'm engaged in a similar type of enterprise here in the UK, and it's a very, which I'll come to later, it's a very difficult thing to do. So in the end, it's a story about persistence, and it's a story about justice. There's a wonderful line in the Torah that justice, only justice shalt thou pursue, and that's very relevant here. So what it also does is it actually tells the story of this flight, particular flight, in the broader context of all of these other terrorist acts that are going on in the last, as I said, last 50, 60 years, well, maybe not that much, but last 40 years.
Yeah.
And so it does talk about, as Kavya said, some of the bombings in Buenos Aires, the bombing in the Beirut, the U.S., it was the U.S.
Well, first it was embassy, the embassy, then embassy, the Marine
and
barracks.
And then there was the
Marine barracks.
And in Kenya.
The barracks, and there was a whole series
Nairobi.
Of different attacks carried out, sponsored by Hezbollah, which is supported and controlled by Iran, and also other terrorist attacks. But it was in that evolving context that Stu had to, and his firm, had to persist with seeking justice for these people, because every time something like that happened, it would change the rules. Because, you know, you'd have a small political backlash and there would be some change. They had to try and represent the interests of their client. It's a very complex balancing act that has to take place. So, you know, you're representing the interests of the Pew family, but also you're trying to make sure that the other Libyans, the other people who suffered as a result of the Lockerbie bombing, also got their just desserts. So it's a very difficult balancing act, and actually it's quite an insight into that whole process. The Lockerbie case is a fascinating case. It was the twin case, if you like, to the UTA flight. I had the good fortune, well, none of this is good fortune, but I was involved with the original Lockerbie case involving the Security Council. So as Stu tells the story, there are so many different ways you can try and get justice for the survivors. You can do it in the domestic courts, which of course is a way forward, and that's the way that ultimately is proving more is proving the best in terms of getting monetary rewards and then in going after the assets of the state that's carried out the attack. But there's also international courts, and so because of and there's the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council, and because the UK and the US had imposed economic sanctions against Libya. So they imposed complete embargoes, basically, embargoes on trade with Libya, including with oil, eventually. Through the UN Security Council, Libya then had to try and respond, because once you cut off the oil, it's going to die, because that was the only source of financing for Gaddafi. In fact, it's a major source of financing for the Iranians and many others today who continue to sponsor terrorism. But as a result of that Security Council action, then Libya sued the UK and the US in the International Court of Justice. So you've got the UN Security Council, which is kind of like the government in the United Nations, the executive arm of the government, and then you've got the International Court of Justice, which is like our here, the UK Supreme Court. And so the Libyans are trying to get the UK Supreme Court equivalent to tell the UK government what to do, which is to stop the sanctions. And so they brought a case in the International Court of Justice, and I was working with Rosalind Higgins, who was an academic and practitioner and became a judge on the International Court, on that Lockerbie case. And it was a remarkable thing, because actually I saw the reassembly, you were talking about the assembly of the baggage hold, I saw the reassembled Lockerbie plane. They actually reassembled it in a hangar in Scotland.
Yeah.
The entire Pan Am flight that had been blown up, and it was just unbelievable to see these kind of bits all stuck together. It was a remarkable thing. But turning, fast forwarding a bit to today, and part of what I'm here to do is to talk about current activity, I think, in the UK context, because what this has done is it's set the standard, and it set the bar, and it's established precedence, which is, of course, for lawyers and those working in colleges, anyone who works in a college will know that precedence is very important. And so what this, all of this work that Stu has done, and others, Carvey and others, has set precedence that now is being used by survivors and their families in other contexts. So reference was made to a number of these cases involving Iran in the US courts. Well, the survivors have come to the United Kingdom to try... is this going to be publicly recorded?
Yeah, it's a
podcast. Oh, okay, fine. Well, then I'll moderate what I'll say. But simply to say that there are efforts ongoing to try and execute the... it's the wrong word. To try and enforce,
in this context.
That's a legal term, which means enforce. To try and enforce these judgments... in the United Kingdom against the assets, the commercial assets of Iran. And those efforts are ongoing and have proven fruitful now. And those relate to not just activities that involve US citizens, although primarily they do. You know, these have taken place all over the world. These terrorist attacks have taken place all over the world. They took place in Saudi Arabia. There was a film, The Kingdom, made with, I think it was, wasn't Denzel Washington, it was some famous...
Jamie Foxx,
yeah, he's a very good actor. Jamie Foxx, which is all about the Cobra Towers bombing, and it was at the time the largest peacetime bomb that had ever been exploded. It was a massive truck was parked outside the Cobra Towers, which are a large high-rise development in Saudi Arabia, and it basically sheared the face off this huge apartment block where a lot of US soldiers and their families were living. It killed a large number of them and of course other people from different countries. And so there have been efforts to try and prosecute, and they obtained judgments in the United States, and those judgments are being enforced here in the United Kingdom. And so what Stu has done has really set the bar, as I've said, for and set a number of precedents that are ongoing and very useful in trying to achieve justice for these victims of terrorism. And my last point on the UK law, we have in the UK the UK State Immunity Act, which is the equivalent. The UK State Immunity Act was passed in 1978. The US was equivalent was passed 2 years earlier, the US Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And both of these acts give a degree of immunity to foreign states from being sued or having their assets taken in the country, so in the US or in the UK. And this is a doctrine of international law. It exists in varying degrees all over the world. And you know, there are cases ongoing all the time about testing the limits to that. But what's interesting now is the US has really led the way in creating an exception for specific terrorist acts. And there are now ongoing cases here that have established that a similar type of exception should exist for terrorist acts here. So in other words, a foreign state that has committed or otherwise controlled or carried out terrorist acts that have an effect on UK citizens or are in some way related to the United Kingdom, then those should be, then their immunity should not exist, so that you should be able to either bring them to court or seize their assets. And that's a very important development. And indeed, with the high increase of terrorist acts in the last three months, my God, maybe the UK needs to take a further step forward and also enact a terrorism exception. Thank you very much for your
time. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. I think first of all I'd like to congratulate Stu on what really is an absolutely fantastic book.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I've ever said this about a law book before, but it is a really gripping read, and I'm going to be quite circumspect in what I say because I don't want to give anything away, and I have definitely never said this about a law book before.
But you can read it on a beach, yes?
No spoilers, yes. It's written in a style that's very accessible to people who are not lawyers, but it doesn't skimp at all on some of the important complexities and conflicts between international law and domestic law, and between the domestic law and the different jurisdictions involved. It's also unusual for a book about law in that there aren't any boring bits. So Stu has stripped out the boring bits. I know from being a litigator that the pursuit of justice in a case like this, there are many hours, many weeks, many months of really, really hard, sometimes quite tedious work. And maintaining that vision of the big picture and maintaining that commitment to the interests of the individual clients, it's sometimes quite difficult when you're in the thick of managing a really big case. But I think the way that you tell this story, the individuals and the harm that is inflicted on the bereaved and those obviously who lose their lives, and the ripple effect from these terrible atrocities. This book actually, I think, it seemed to me at the heart of it, the most moving section. Spoiler alert, I'll try not to give anything away. There's a very moving section quite a long way into the book where in the process of the trial, it seemed to me that what you were doing is giving voice to those victims through the process of the civil justice system. And in doing so, giving that voice and really sort of in a forum where the other noise, the extraneous noise, stops, and the clatter around international diplomacy and politics and power and money is stripped away, and in the forum of the court, these families have an opportunity to try and understand what happened to their loved ones, but also an opportunity to give their testimony. And that's a really powerful, powerful part of the book, and it seemed to me it spoke volumes about the importance of the independence and impartiality of the justice system, the individual constitutional rights of access to justice, access to the courts, And it illustrated to me how that is not just about procedure and due process being a procedural right. It is actually about the fundamental nature of what it is to be an autonomous human being with dignity, that part of being able to have a voice, to challenge those in authority, to bring people to account who have committed these terrible atrocities, it is a part of human dignity, and we should not forget that. And just looking at the way that the three different legal systems went about the pursuit of justice and the protection, ultimately, of human dignity, I found very fascinating in this book. There's obviously the criminal side and the civil side, and in each of the jurisdictions in the US, in France, and in the UK, Scotland, those played out in very different ways. But at the same time, they're interacting a lot with the internal politics and the external international politics and diplomacy and international law. So the French case, fascinating, obviously, for me as a comparative lawyer interested in access to justice, and particularly access to justice in mass harm, cross-border disputes. It was fascinating to read about the way that Bougier, the French investigating magistrate, went about his job of unearthing this. It really is an incredible detective story. But it seemed to me there's a very stark contrast between that and the way that the FBI and Scotland Yard investigated Lockerbie, and how the French criminal case seemed to be, from the information you were able to get your hands on, he dug up so much of the crucial evidence before they even got to the point of laying charges.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Lockerbie case, under the common law system, the UK obviously and USA have very strong historical links in terms of the legal system, and it's quite different to the French system. And in the Lockerbie case, well, we had this extraordinary thing of the court being set up in the Hague, outside the jurisdiction. I don't think it's ever been done before, and Is it likely to ever be done again? It's something we should talk about when there are these types of international cases, cross-border cases. But the way that the FBI and Scotland Yard investigation was pursued, and I guess that's partly because of the different the legal and systemic differences between the US and UK and France, that really the evidence was quite circumstantial, and when the case played out, it was pretty much circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
At the end of the day, the Malta connection.
Mm-hmm.
And quite extraordinary that Megrahi was convicted at all. And extraordinary in the French case that the defendants were not there. And what impact would that have had if it had been the Lockerbie case? Discuss. It's an interesting question. And then also on the civil side, I think your case demonstrated very powerfully the importance of civil justice, that it's not just about having a public criminal accountability process where the state is responsible for investigating and prosecuting and punishing these gross violations of public norms, and as part of their duty to protect citizens, but also that criminal process doesn't necessarily give the victims a voice, although the French process does. Unlike the Scottish legal system and the US criminal system, in France you have this process by which individual victims can join in the criminal prosecution as civil parties, parties civile, and they can be awarded compensation off the back of that. And that's something that's been discussed a lot in policy conversations in the European Union, whether or not that kind of a system is a good solution to cross-border, multi-party or mass harm claims, where you have a criminal prosecution that's largely controlled by the state, and therefore the sort of resources that are put into that don't get sort of scattered and lost by this dreadful US-style litigation. Gets a lot of bad press here. And instead you have a party civil system, but it seemed to me that that too didn't deliver complete justice for the French, and there were a lot of frustrations there. And in your case, as I said, the really startling way in which the victims did have a voice and did obtain justice. We don't want to give away too much. But I think, yes, and it seemed to me, I mentioned the point earlier on about human dignity and the importance of the victims having a voice, and I was reminded while I was reading this book about the German constitution, which in its post-war complete reconstruction, it puts so much emphasis on the idea of human dignity, and as part of that, the individual right of access to the court. It is regarded in law as a really critical part of human dignity, and that's very important in the post-Holocaust, post-war era. And the Germans have been very rigorous in defending that right when in conversation with the European Union about how to deal with cross-border mass harm claims, that they really do believe that this is absolutely critical, that they preserve that individual right of access to the court, and we mustn't have what are called opt-out class actions where the individual loses that right, because in losing that right, you're losing your voice in that protected sphere, which is part of your human dignity. And I think the final point I'd like to make, which is really just a question I'm going to pose to Stu, and hopefully to open it up to discussion following that, is we look towards the US Constitution from this side of the Atlantic with a degree of envy that it has such such clearly entrenched protections of civil and political rights, which we just don't have here in the same way. But it's not, to me, as a lawyer and an academic, it's not just about the way that the rights are entrenched in the Constitution, and recognising the fact that they're going through an interesting stress test at the moment, but it's also the fact that they're embedded in the social and political consciousness of the population, and the idea of your constitutional rights really seems to me to be part of your identity as an American citizen. Mm-hmm. So I read this book really with that kind of sort of consciousness in mind of your legal system. And at the end, again, without wanting to give away anything, there is a really important, you have to read to the end of this book, as to what happens at the end of the case. And it really struck me as I felt very conflicted about my understandings of constitutional rights and the way that the Constitution and due process rights in the US can control executive power. And it seemed to me my sort of fairy tale ideal of the American Constitution has been really quite tarnished by reading to the end of your book and what happens at the end. I don't know if you can respond to that without giving it away, because I want everybody here to go and buy a copy and read to the end, and I don't want to spoil it. So really that's how I'd like to conclude. Throw it open to you to respond.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.